Verulam Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome again to Verulam Sport Podcast, in the highlight of my week, and I'm sure it's yours too. I've been really looking forward to this one because this week the team has got a new member. I'm going to welcome him to you in just a second, and we are all going to be analysing, debating and dissecting the relationship between not just peak level performance sports, but the role and the ever advancing role of tech in sport. I know you guys have had your views, and I'm encouraging you to use the tech of social media to keep involved. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. And in just a second, we're going to hear from our man, the machine, Jason McKenna, for the social media updates. But just briefly, I feel it's appropriate right now to welcome to you our newest member. It's an honour and indeed a massive privilege to welcome to Verulam Sport Podcasting for the very first time tonight, Neil Stark. Good evening, Neil.
Evening, Tony. How are you?
Hey, we're doing really well. As always, I'm conscious that we're living in challenging times, but these little conversations about all things sport keep me sane and well, and I hope that comes across and translates and impacts on you out there listening in. Neil, I'm really looking forward to your contributions to tonight and going forwards. But right now, it's appropriate in the context of a debate about tech and sport to go across to the man that we know as the machine, Jason McKenna. Social media has been going crazy as always. What you got for us?
Yes, so actually added to the mix of talking about tech in sport, we had two polls this week. And the first one was about all the goings on at Ferrari and in Formula One. And that question was actually about, can we consider Vettel a success or a failure during his time at Ferrari? And there was no beating around the bush here. Everybody, 100% of people, voted that Vettel was a failure. So I don't know if people think that's harsh, and obviously I'll point it back to Tony's fantastic conversation with Kerry Cobb a little bit earlier. But just quickly there, Tony, do you think that that was a bit harsh on the four-time world champion?
You know what? I think it's a really fascinating point, and it's unanimous. Our social media voters have, done their thing. But again, of course, if you've got a different view, if you think he was rather good actually at Ferrari in context, love to hear you. Get involved always. Tweet at Verulam Sports. However, again, I think it always comes down to this weird relationship between expectation and the reality of wherever those expectation bars are. As it came in from a four-time world championship, when literally between 2010 through to 2013, untouchable, four consecutive championships, to then what was at best lukewarm flashes of genius. I just never felt that he was at peace in that Ferrari seat. Never quite did the business. So again, flashes of genius for me. I think maybe he's a little harsh to deem it an absolute resounding mess, but you couldn't either call it a success. So I suppose fair comments, guys, but again, keep your comments coming at Verulam Sport. And Jason, I know another poll and loads more interaction. What's going on?
So obviously this week we're talking about technology in sport. So I put it up again to the people because we love making it your show. We love getting you involved. And this week's question was, is technology's presence in sport a good or a bad thing? And this one was a little bit more mixed. So 80% of people actually said yes, it does improve sport, but 20% of people were actually a bit more on the edge, and they said it's a mix, it can have some negative effects. And we also did have some great comments coming in. Biggest Mickus was once again on the Twitter. He's a fantastic
friend
contributor.
Of the show. Gotta love that man.
He does it each week. He always presents a really interesting point. And he said there is no reason why a ball can't be chipped to link with a goal or try line sensors to indicate its position at a given point in the game. Likewise, any opportunity to shame footballers rolling about on the ground by reviewing tackles on the big screen should be implemented. So I think that is a really good point there. Then Mandy has been in touch. She said, Hawkeye has been great in tennis and has added to drama on the day. I absolutely love it. And Michael has said, In some cases, it is good. Cricket and tennis, it's been a resounding success. Whereas In football, it's actually ruined the league this year. I think that's a discussion we'll get onto a little bit later with VAR. But that is the social media there. But we've got to get into the discussions, don't we, Tony?
We certainly do. But I tell you what, there's already those wonderful foods for thought provided by the great listeners. And as always, it's your show every bit as much as it is ours. So continue to keep involved. 80% say tech enhances sport. That's quite telling. And we're going to now get down into it. There, we've embraced social media. We love a good tweet at Verum Sports and continue to do just that. But now I'm going to introduce again to the show, Neil Stock, to tell us your thoughts, please, on the role and relationship of social media in sport and both the pros and the cons. Fire away, Neil.
Well, social media, as we know at Verulam Sport, is a very, very, very big thing in sport. It keeps supporters and clubs, players, professionals within the game, whatever sport it may be, it keeps people in the loop. However, that's a big pro of it. However, the major con that I feel with social media as it stands at the moment, it highlights the criticisms that players may have with something that's happened on the pitch in football, for instance, whether it may be a tackle and say Harry Kane tweets something that may be a bit close to the line, or whoever it may be, it could be a manager. However, there's nothing set in stone really within any club or any sport that I'm aware of to actually haul those people up and say, well, hang on a minute, you're not only representing yourself, you're representing us as a club or a sport. But that, and there's also, it goes the other way, whereas, and this is a big topic I know, it can and has done in the past highlighted and brought to the front and brought to the fore of sport racism.
A high
intake of that going on social media, whether it be Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, or even down as far as WhatsApp maybe. But it's just so much goes on within social media that you don't really necessarily hear about the good bits that happen with social media in sport. It's always the bad bits are highlighted, and there's no other than Sir Tom, who's raised the money for the NHS through a very minor sporting, what I would say, sporting event to raise money for the NHS. I know it's sort of going off topic slightly, but that highlighted something very, very big, which that's what sport should be about. They should embrace the social media, use it correctly. If it's used correctly, certain number of people within a team, within a club, association, maybe, this is only my view and my idea, maybe have access to post whatever's needed.
I think you've got to be careful there, because ultimately the beauty of it, and indeed it does open up a Pandora's box, as you beautifully framed, of potential negativity. But the beauty of it is that it is, kind of totally free form expression. It is at the moment non-policed. And I think it's wonderful for people crossing all sports to be able to engage, to almost consider themselves a brand. But you're right, they do represent, and that has to be considered. And it is a strange relationship. And I think you were very right, kind of to anchor the negativity, the trolling that can occur often in a racist context. Again, obviously, don't want to go too much into depth here, but racism, of course, very much in the zeitgeist at this present time. But I think can be a wonderful, powerful device, and but ultimately is this almost neo Wild West. Graham, again, our ex-pro, the voice of the Saints, in your time when you were doing your thing on the pitch, I'm guessing maybe as a bit of Facebook, but probably at its infancy, what's your take on the power, both positive and indeed potentially negative, of social media in the context of sport?
Well, firstly, thank God we didn't have it back in the day, right? It's sort of, you know, we sort of could live life a little bit. But I think a couple of things. I think no news is bad news. So I think news, if it's popular or not, is good because it's a level of communication. And I think as well with the social media type, I think it gives a voice to fans, doesn't it? Rather than an editor on a news show or a producer, you know, as we've got on the team here. So it enables a true, accurate picture for people to have a voice. If there's issues in there that are not liked or popular, well, I wouldn't say that's necessarily tech in sport. I would say that's societal. Mm. So that's society given as an example. I actually quite like social media from a perspective of what we're doing now. You know, if we think of this as a podcast for our community, and, you know, the effort that yourself, Tony, and obviously Jason and everybody else associated puts into this on a voluntary basis, this is excellent, right? As you said earlier, you enjoy this part of the week. I certainly love it talking about it.
Highlight of my week, Graham, honestly. It really is. Keeps me sane.
Right. So, you know, it's wonderful, isn't it? This is a form of social media, and it gives us a platform to have our voice. And so I think it just gets to the masses a bit easier. Yes, there's issues with it, there's negativity around it. And when it comes down to the players in itself, then that's down to their training and coaching that they're having internally in the clubs. So I would say that would be down to their comms teams or their training teams to give them the support. These are young men still, you know, they're still 19, 20, 21. These are people, there's a lot going on in their heads. So what support is there for them? So overall, I would say it's a pro.
I'm inclined to agree. Neil, beg your pardon. I'm just going to fire it across quickly to our social media group because there's so much that we've got to cover in tonight's topic of debate. Sport and tech, get involved. Tweet at Realm Sport. Use the power of social media positively. Jason, though, you are our very own social media guru. You earn the moniker machine in this context, sir. Can you give me your just brief overview of the interrelationship between the brand individual and the person representing the club and how they apply the power of social media?
Yeah, it's a great debate here, and I love the topic, Neil. Thanks very much for bringing it up. I think in terms of social media and sport, it's a debate that's going to rage on for years and years because, as Tony's rightly kind of pointed out, it is an open network and it brings the huge positives of that, but also the huge negatives. For me personally, again, I kind of agree with Graham here that I'm a really positive person in general about social media. What I really like as well is it's kind of the modern game, the modern player, and those who use it right can really make a difference, positive things. You look at people like Marcus Rashford, you know, he's kind of used that platform to highlight, for example, sign language for deaf people. He's kind of made that almost a little bit mainstream to now start learning that and think outside the box of actually how football should be for everybody, regardless of any sort of things and ability as well. So I think there's a lot of positives there. Also, my final point on it is I really like the almost connectiveness of sports players and the fact that you can almost see inside their psyche, coupled up with these amazing fly-on-the-wall documentaries that we're seeing now, like the Amazon Prime Man City one. I think it's all kind of tied that footballers, yes, they're at this level, but also they're like you and me. They've got emotions, they've got thoughts and feelings, and you kind of see that much more now, whereas before it was kind of closed shop and you only had interviews with papers and sometimes on the TV and radio to get in their psyche.
Again, it's that interaction. It's wonderful. And we want to keep you interacting with us. Keep involved. Remember, it's your show every bit as much as it is ours. And I tell you what, moving things on now, I know you have got so many opinions on this one. I'm just going to simply utter maybe the most controversial acronym in all of planet Earth right now, VAR. We're going to get down into this. I'm just going to ping this across to the guys, but quickly, I was reading back in February now, so, you know, again, a little while back, a YouGov survey of nearly 1,400 fans, 1,396 to be precise, regular Premier League viewers only gave the VAR score assessment out of 10, so not exactly a scientific metric, but just an insight into that sample's mind view, and it's a fairly robust sample, 4 out of 10, a meager 4 out of 10. 6 out of 10 people, according to this sample, again of nearly 1,400, said that VAR worked badly, but they acknowledged the ability of similar technology. Can't wait to talk about Hawkeye in a bit on this regard, by the way, Graham. But they acknowledged 6 out of 10, according to this sample, that VAR worked badly, but they saw similar technologies working well in other sports. Here's where it gets interesting, though. Only 15%, so despite that kind of negative trend, only 15% of people in this February sample said they would be actually in favour of scrapping VAR entirely. So sense of kind of teething troubles, and I'm sure we've all got opinions on it, but overall it's not something that the fan, according to this sample back in Feb, would want to remove. But it's a massive topic, and I know you've got views on them, but I cannot wait to hear the views now of our data guru, the man, the machine, the legend that is Jason McKenna. What you got for us, buddy?
Yeah, so in terms of VAR, it is probably one of the most controversial subjects this season. As we saw from our social media input, somebody said it's ruined this season. I'm going to go through my half argument for VAR because I too realise the limitations, but also the benefits. Just for a little fun fact before we get into this, Kelechi Iheanacho from Leicester City can be the first player to be awarded goal from VAR. He can have that great mantle in terms of footballing history. But he got it to complete a brace in a 2-0 win in the FA Cup.
Tell you what, pub quizzes, get that one noted because it's going to come up in a pub quiz somewhere down the line before too long. I love that, Jason. Brilliant.
We do like to give those kind of funny pub quizzes. And also, I did look at some good referendums, if you will, on VAR. And the one that I found with 24,000 participants conducted by The Athletic said that 55% of people would keep it in the sport. So again, kind of echoing what you said there, Tony, that people are still willing to give it a chance, can see the merits of it, but they're just not very happy with it.
Well, lots of controversial memories and moments of this. And many times I feel as though Watford were kind of afflicted in this. And just, again, we maybe delve into that momentarily. Jason, I'm going to come back to you, but just want to whip it across now to Neil again for your tuppence on the fawny, wonderful debate topic of VAR.
Well, to be honest, I do think it's helped the game in some respects because it's basically it's given another angle for the referee for their decision making. However, there are still the is it, isn't it, am I meant to, am I not meant to, that there's still that, and you still got the players surrounding referees even though he's seen his VAR screen and whatever decision's been made from that. So where do you think, guys, do you think this that could be improved? Because there still is a lot of decisions that are correct through VAR against the ones that are wrong.
I think some of it comes down to almost the VAR being terribly literal. And I think it may be now the time for some of the rules themselves to either be simplified or just kind of made really rather clear. And then I think we can progress. But Jason, again, I'm coming back to you. And then I cannot wait for the always erudite footballing analysis from our man, the voice of the Saints, Graham. But just whipping it back to Jason on VAR and maybe your suggestions for streamlining.
Oh, well, now that is another point about what I think should happen. But I think the starting point for a lot of people is this removal or so-called removal of goal celebrations. Jurgen Klopp himself actually said, I don't celebrate goals anymore because you have to wait until somebody says that it's a goal. Now, I think this is a little bit extreme, in my opinion, because we have seen throughout this whole season plenty of goals celebrated, people run into the touchline because they've scored an absolute worldie. And in terms of contentious situations, for me, again, I think I just look at seasons gone by. You know, somebody's scored it a goal and then they look across and they you know, raise their hands up in anger because they see that the offside flag is given. But then there might be a short discussion between referee and linesman, and then the goal is given or taken away. So I still think it's a dramatic element that has always been there in football. It's just this protracted nature. On that specific topic, I don't know how to speed that up, because I like and I think that referees should embrace it maybe a little bit more, that they actually run to the touchline and look at the video and have a discussion with this person, because it's all kind of done by this anonymous figure of Stockley Park, whereas instead, I think the referee who is actually officiating the game should be involved with this discussion. I've got other points, so I don't know if Graham, Tony, or Neil, if you've got any kind of additions to my points on that first initial kind of gripe that I have with it.
Super quickly, and then I'm going to throw it to Graham before circling back to yourself, and then we do have to keep rocking and rolling. But basically, one of my major concerns with this, and this is not just in football and VAR, but I find it from a rugby perspective in particularly too. You used the phrase almost passé nowadays. The linesman, of course, the third official, I think, is their official title. But the point is, I feel as though they're almost becoming obsolete, because the referee will, of course, kind of go to some form of computer-based decision-making assistance. And oftentimes, the beauty of what was once upon a time known as a linesman, and of course, lined ladies these days, which is wonderful, the bottom line is this: they often are incredibly well-placed, actually have maybe the best perspective. And I feel as though the loss of authority to that aspect of the game, particularly when it concerns offside decisions, is a concern to me. And I have it in a rugby perspective, whereby the referee will just default go to the kind of computer-aided decision-making, when in fact, again, he or she often has the best view in the house, and the linesmen are on hand, or the third officials supremely well placed to guide. So I find that maybe something, again, that needs to be ironed out and considered. But I really now cannot wait to hear the considered opinions of the voice of the Saints, and again, our ex-footballing pro, Mr. Graham Griffin. VAR for you, what's your thoughts?
Video assistant referee, Oh, what a term. I'm glad they abbreviated it in the first instance to help us with that. So I'm delighted to announce I'm in the 20% of our wonderful listeners in the St. Albans community, and are totally against VAR to a high percentage. And the reasons are similar to what you've been saying there, Tony, but also let's think about this for a minute. It is ruining the game for several reasons. So let's just empathise for a minute and put ourselves in the shoes. We're a referee, right? We're a trained referee. We're earning. We're part-time, full-time. We've got fitness checks. We've got science. You know, we're learning how to communicate. We're getting paid very well. And you know the laws of the game. You've studied it all your career. You've been through them horrible Sunday mornings when some fists come flying at you and you see broken legs and everything, you know, all the way through to the top of the game. And then all of a sudden that power or that autonomy is taken away from them. And that's really what's happening, is that the referee now is in a rock and a hard place. They can't win. And then obviously it is going to Stockley Park. And the problem with that is this: we've seen so earlier on in the season, the technology is still not that accurate. The communication, the processes, they're still working on it. And I get that, change, new things, no problems with that. But the reality is, when you're looking at a millimetre of a striker offside because his kneecap's hanging out, isn't that ridiculous? I mean, come on. The game was all about, the excitement is, give the benefit to the striker so we can see a goal have that Europa and just
real quickly on that.
Enjoy.
Just really quickly on that. I think cricket have got this quite well done in the sense that whether it's, for instance, a bowler bowls it and it is given out, okay? In the cricketing kind of context of going to question the decision, it has to be proven categorically beyond any major slither of a doubt that the umpire was incorrect in his decision to give the batsman out. By contrast, if it's the other way around and the umpire kind of said, oh, batsman's in, and then it's reviewed by the bowler, again, same principle, but just reverse. So in that context, it must be proven beyond any reasonable doubt that the umpire's decision was incorrect and that therefore the batsman should be given out and reverse the decision. So ultimately, they utilize the technology to limit error, and it's still not flawless, but I think has got much better fan response than football of late. But basically, again, it's the umpire is the guide, if that makes sense, and has to be proven wrong as opposed to sort of this nebulous kind of, as you say, a kneecap ish is off and it's all a bit uncertain. So I think cricket's got quite a good thing on that.
Yeah, it's what I would say there is, and within cricket as well, they have a limited number of opportunities.
Isn't it? Three appeals, basically, or three challenges.
Yeah, three challenges, yeah. And I think if they brought something similar in line into the football, which would then give the referee back that little bit of control which has been taken away from VAR by VAR, then I think that may, and it also gives a little bit of respect back to the player, if you like, and the officials, because at the end of the day, there are five or six officials at a game. And at least out of those five or six officials, there's always a monitor there, especially in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. They're going to be able to see a goal line replay. And surely there should be somebody in the ground sat on a video saying, right, yeah, this is what's happened. However, if it's contested, then we'll look at it. If it's not, let it fly as it was.
So I just to wrap up there as well, I think other sports, it does work. So if we look at rugby, as you say, Tony, TMO, I love TMO as a fan because it engages me, it tells me what's going on, and it's for that decision of a bad, injustice fight, or mainly for a try when it can't be seen if it's upended. Now, if we look at athletics, I think Jace mentioned, it makes total sense for it to work in athletics for that kneecap because it's a straight over the line. Who's one, two, and three? In football, it's not that type of sport. And it doesn't make sense to utilise that type of technology, in my view, when there's so many facets going on with 22 people and a referee and the relationships that are going on. However, having said that, there's one place I think it can work and should stay, which is penalties. And that was the original design of it anyway. So keep it as penalties because that is the most frustrating area for the fan when you can see it in a seat but the ref can't see it or the lino can't see it, whatever the situation. Penalties, defo, everything else, forget it. And it doesn't matter if there's a foul that's gone wrong or something else has happened. So to wrap up, VAR, thinking the terms of football as a sport, would be very useful for penalty decisions. But outside of that, I don't see any purpose. And for keeping the sanity of a fan base, for the beautiful game as we all love and adore, then VAR is a thumbs down for me.
Thumbs down from Graham, but it had a big thumbs up from 80% of our listeners. Anecdotally, again, our friend Richard Walker, make sure you're tuning in next week ahead of their return to the Premier League against Leicester City. We'll be back with Richard. I remember talking to him about VAR, and he's also a bit of a romantic heart like you and I, Graham. He's that old one, that cliche, but it's a truism. Swings and roundabouts was his attitude, and at the moment it remains to be seen which way the swing of VAR is going. But Jason, I do appreciate it. Again, 80% were on board, and I know you've still got a few other VAR points you'd like to address tonight.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd finish up because I think maybe this is such a grand topic that maybe it needs its own kind of dedicated Verulam Sport podcast, because it is really contentious, and I've got a plethora of kind of reasons for and against. But one point that maybe, Graham, you can get on board with, and maybe Neil as well, in terms of our social media discussion as well, I think that VAR has really shifted the debate from blame the referee to blame this nameless technology. And I think in terms of mental health, because obviously last week or the week before it was Mental Health Awareness Week, I think must unarguably be said that VAR has taken the pressure off referees who were in previous years and even months gone by before it was implemented in the Premier League. They were called out, they were lambasted, and quite frankly, sometimes horrendously criticised in the media for what it was, this basic human error. You know, it was human decisions, and no matter what people say, football isn't worth, you know, possibly making some of these referees have anxiety or even suicidal depressive thoughts. So,
Jason, real quickly, I think that's a very, very powerful point, and I'm in complete agreement. However, the only thing I would add about that, the principle's powerful, but as you know, and we all appreciate, VAR only pertains in the Premier League, where, of course, down the lower leagues, there's still going to be that necessary vitriol imposed, and indeed, arguably, where this particular problem, it becomes really more manifest, not to denigrate the issues and, of course, the implications of the pressures of being a referee. I do not wish it upon anybody. Goodness me, respect to them all massively. But where I would say that this really kicks in, Graham, you kind of painted the wonderful picture of that referee's journey, but you've seen it yourself, I'm sure. It's at that non-televised kind of mud parks, basically Sunday league, where the next generation Premier League refs must cut their teeth, that they're going to really totally experience this. And I would never suggest that VAR filters its all the way down to the lowest of the grassroots levels. But again, heed your point. I think you made it really well, Jason. But again, we're looking at the very tip of the iceberg there. I think that mega issue of mental health in sport is one you can expect to get our thoughts in much more detail in an upcoming Verulam Sport podcast.
But I do appreciate jump in on that as well. Point.
Yeah, go for it, Neil.
One quick thing, though, is I would say, going back onto the health issue that Jace very rightly did bring up, I think really because there are a minimum on the Premier League side anyway of four, potentially five officials, the job shouldn't be all piled onto that one person in the middle of the park. It should be a spread even job.
Because but then I guess, I mean, are we not into too many cooks syndrome just there? I don't know. As Neil, but it's an interesting point. And again, always encourage you to get involved. Everything VAR and everything sport and tech debate. It's the debate we're having. Jason, anything else finally before we do have to progress past this contentious one of that dreaded acronym VAR?
No, I think we've given a good insight into obviously the multitude of debates. And as I said, I think it might be poignant at another time, especially when the Premier League is back, which we're all excited for, to debate it more. Because I think obviously this is kind of a debate about tech in sport. It's not about VAR in football. So I think we've done our job in that sense of highlighting what are positives and negatives of VAR.
Again, there's no question about it. This acronym will not go away. We'll be mentioning it, I'm sure, in the coming weeks and months. Make sure you're with us every week for Verulam Sport Podcasting. Next week, we will be shining a light because we're all delighted to have the return of the Premier League, albeit, of course, for obvious reasons, behind closed doors. But stick tuned for that. We've also got Richard Walker coming up next week as well. So there's always massively jam-packed Verulam Sports Podcasting for you to enjoy in the coming weeks. But now, going across from the slightly contentious area of VAR to a sport which I think has really got this technology in judgment situation down to a strong art form now. And I'm going to talk about Hawkeye in tennis generally, but it really does span multiple sports, to our man, Graham Griffin, who I know has got one of the greatest anecdotes I've heard in a long time, and particularly connected to Hawkeye. Put us in the picture, Graham.
Yes. So before I get onto that little story, Tony, a bit of excitement in my mind. So this is my third and final pitch of Tech in Sport. I've had started off with social media as being a pro and VAR as being a con, so a negative. Which way am I going to go? I'm going to go with a positive for Hawkeye. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And so just to give us a bit of insight before my personal experience with it, I'd like to test the knowledge of our wonderful Radio Verulam sports team. So, Tony, in a minute, I'm going to start with you, then I'm going to go Jason, and then I'm going to go Neil. So you just need a quick fire answer to the questions I fire at you. So here goes. First question is going to be, so what is Hawkeye? Is it a computer system? Is it a TV screen? Or is it infrared? Tony?
Great question, Graham. I'll tell you what, I like this. Changing it up, getting us on our feet, always good.
Adding drama.
I'm in sort of two minds here. I know you wanted quick fire. I'm in two minds between the computer technology side and the infrared. And I'm going to lean towards, although I know it's heavily influenced from a Wimbledon perspective with IBM, which would need me to think a computer side. For some reason or other, I'm going to go Hawkeye is predominantly infrared. Correct me, though, if I am wrong.
Thank you, Tony. Jason?
I like that you're bringing a little bit of drama to the Verulam Sport podcast in the absence of sport, but I'm going to go with infrared as well. I think Tony's made the right decision on that one.
Thanks, Jason. And Neil?
I think infrared, but potentially a little bit of computer as well. So I'm sort of torn between two, a bit like Tony, I think.
I love how you all went slightly infrared, which does have an element to it. So it's like, trick question. It's a computer system which is used in numerous sports. And them numerous sports are, let's say, the seven main numerous sports that use Hawkeye at the moment. Which two of those seven sports are non-British based but still within the Isles? Tony?
Good question, this one. I'll tell you what. The only for me, I'm just going to go this. I guess this is a universal sport played around the globe. But for me, when I hear Hawkeye, I instantaneously think tennis. So I want to put tennis as that sort of starter for 10. And in terms of the second of seven, now there is a very, very good question. I will say. It's definitely not within the islands. Well, let's go for, I don't know, let's go for keeping it on the Celtic side of things. Let's go for Gaelic football.
Love your thinking, Tony. Jess?
Maybe Tony will correct me on this, but I'm thinking NFL and also Major League Baseball. I just have the feeling that they're two sports, especially Major League Baseball, that could benefit from that kind of system.
Thank you. And Neil?
Golf and horse racing, maybe, or possibly athletics.
Good guesses, guys. And I think Tony was the closest. It's actually Gaelic football and Gaelic hurling. The two Irish sports are where Hawkeye is used. And obviously tennis, as you said there, Tony. Next question. So the whole idea of Hawkeye really is to, it's to track, it's a visual track of the trajectory of the ball displaying the statistical movement or the moving image of it. But What is that trajectory called? It's two words and it's specific to that trajectory. So, Tony, any guesses?
Do you know what? You have totally flummoxed me here. I'm just going to give this an educated guess and I'm going to say forward thrust.
Thank you. Good guess. Jess?
Ball velocity.
Okay, I like it, Neil.
It's something to do with speed, because I know within tennis you can they work out how fast the ball has been served, etc. So speed, I say, is one of them. The other one, I wouldn't have a clue.
Like you're thinking, the exact terminology for it is shot spot. So that's the terminology to explain of how Hawkeye uses imagery to find the trajectory of the ball. Next quick question. So the inventor of Hawkeye, what is his name? He is from the United Kingdom. Is it Trevor Hawkins, Richard Hawkins, or Paul Hawkins? Tony?
OK, Again, loving the questions, and this is a real fun little piece. And I'm going to go Richard Hawkins.
Thank you, Jess.
I thought the guy's name was actually John Hawke or something like that, because I was actually reading about this before, but it shows how much actually went into my brain. So I'm just going to go with Tony and say Richard Hawkins as well.
Excellent. And Neil?
Trevor Hawkins, I reckon. I don't actually know, but that's a wild guess.
So it's Paul Hawkins. He invented it in 2001. And he's Hawkeye is owned by Sony, believe it or not, as a technology company. And then one last question then just to throw in there before we share a little bit more. In what Premier League season was Hawkeye introduced? In what Premier League season? Was it 2005, 6, 2010, 11, or 2013-14?
So Tony. Invented in 2001. We are a little slow to embrace these. I'm going to go 2005, 2006.
Jess?
I think it's 13-14 because it had, I think, the Lampard goal, if we all remember, from the World Cup where the ball was supposed to go over the line, but it didn't. And arguably, some people would say it cost England in the World Cup. That was 2010. And I think there was a big furore for goal line technology, and it was brought in a little bit later. I'm assuming it's for goal line technology. I might be totally off here, but that's the reasons for my explanation.
Thanks, Jess. And Neil?
I was thinking along the lines of 13-14, purely because the conversations of goal line technology have been going on for at least the last 10 years, if not longer.
And superb. So two of you are correct. It is 2013-14 season, which is, what, six or seven seasons away. And finally, for me to wrap up on Hawkeye, which I think is absolutely a fantastic piece of technology, in particular in football, is that I had the pleasure of, when it first came out, meeting Paul Hawkins, and I had the pleasure of putting on the watch that the referee wears. So referees, if you've noticed, they wear, normally used to wear one watch. Some would wear two anyway as a backup in case the other failed. So you might see now, you'll definitely see football referees with two watches. Some might have three. But the second one is a very big digital, it's a bit like the whole Casio watch back in the 80s, on their wrist. And I actually got the joy of kicking this ball over a line on a Premier League football pitch, and how accurate this ringing on my wrist of the goal line technology Hawkeye watch, I couldn't believe the accuracy. And even when I rolled my foot forward and backwards to check it and test it, as you would with curiosity, it was so accurate. And back to the original first question, where I could see why you were all thinking infrared. It does have infrared. And basically, they have six cameras quite high up on the top of the stadium, all linking into specific points of that whole goal net. And then that draws a map or a visual from a computer software point of view. Mm-hmm. So it recognises that ball. And then that technology of speed to get to that watch, it is 100% accurate with that referee. So if you see where you think it's over the line and the ref looks at his watch and it's not, trust me, it's 100% accurate. So it was a great experience, and that's why I like that tech in sport.
Gets a big thumbs up for me, as indeed that whole segment did, Graham. Saluting you, loving your work. Just quickly, before we progress again, circle us back, because what an experience to have that opportunity. How did it come about?
So I was working in, obviously, Premier League football, and within that sort of sphere was it was a day where I think it was a press release, so I was involved in that in some sort of capacity, and I remember meeting the technicians of the Hawkeye team. There was probably about six of them at the time, and I remember one of them just came up to me and introduced himself. So, oh yeah, I'm going to be here. So they have small teams on every sort of Premier League ground, if you like, doing whatever checks they're doing. And they said, yeah, have a go. So I went, oh, okay. Put the watch on, kicked the ball in the net, took it back out, kicked it in the net, rolled it over the net, put my head down to see if it would work that way. I tried everything. So I got a real personal touch and experience. And it just made me think, wow, this is when technology can help the sport, not hinder it, as we've discussed with VAR in certain respects.
Do you know what was really, really key there? As you say, when it's done well, I think we would be foolish not to appreciate the power of technology to enhance the quality, the speeds, the accuracy of decision making, and the overall enhancements of, for people like us, the fanatics of the world. Again, it's just always these murky areas that don't quite connect. But I think from Hawkeye, from my perspective, certainly as a fan of tennis, I just think it's added such a great element to. I know initially Federer was a little bit bullshy about it, is almost, which I find a bit of a paradox because, again, he's not exactly going to be utilizing 1970s tech in his tennis rackets, I would say. But he was very kind of anti it initially, but I think he's now fully on board. But for me, my perspective, Hawkeye, wonderful. Jason, yeah, quickly coming back to you then. Again, my perspective, Hawkeye-wise, just nothing but double thumbs up. Your initial take and impression on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got an anecdote from my grandmother. She was actually talking to me, you know, obviously building up to the Verulam Sport podcast. She's a big fan. She loves listening to all of us and getting involved. And she actually said that she had a hands-on experience with Hawkeye. My uncle's actually kind of coaching Greg Rogetsky, who was had at one point the fastest ever serve. And so she got a little kind of unique VIP experience with Paul to kind of look at the technology. So she was right on the byline, so she could see the kind of technology in action. And kind of exactly what you said there, Graham, she was fascinated and blown away by the instantaneous nature that these decisions are made. So yeah, I think for me, Tony, I love the fact that it's a technology that kind of goes across the sports as well. So it's not just tennis, but it's football. And as you correctly highlighted there, Graham, it is Gaelic football. It's across the globe. But I think with football, an undoubted success, with tennis, an undoubted success. And hopefully we won't be seeing any more of those Lampard moments, which, you know, as a fan of fairness in football, I would say that it was heartbreaking to see England kind of, it was a game-changing moment. Psychologically, in all the facets about it, you're going to go, God, it's all against
me. From memory, they were then latterly overclassed, I think, after that controversial moment. It must be said for kind of anchoring it in its proper history, so to speak. But yeah. Yes.
2010 World Cup, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Germany game. And I think there were obviously questionable decisions were made with teams and lineups and tactics. But what I would say, again, Graham, you can probably give more insight, but in a game like that with fine margins, it was an equalising goal, or it would have been if it counted. As a player, would you then start maybe questioning the system? Would you go, oh, it's just not our day today? Is it really hard to get over one of those psychological hurdles?
Well, it depends on strength of character. So if you look at the Germans' response at the time, Neuer, I think, was the goalkeeper. He was like, I can't believe that's not given. He just looked at the ref, he looked around, he could see the ball was way over the line. And then he looked at the ref, because the ref, he was assuming, was going to blow for a goal. And then the Germans psychologically would have collapsed, I think, in that game at that point. But it actually boosted the Germans, because the English lost their heads and they were gutted, rightly so, because it was a wonderful goal. And I think England were on top then, so I think England would have actually gone on to do something. But they just couldn't get back. They just felt that's been the story for England teams, isn't it? As we discussed in the last podcast.
Though, just to cut in short there, we need to one day have a conversation about this, okay? Because for me, and this is just my views, I genuinely think it is an absolute abject disgrace that we haven't had a trophy at football at the highest level since 66, okay? If you consider the passion for it in this country, the wealth of resources, the finances, etc. If you consider in that 50-year span, nations like, and I mean no disrespect, goodness me, they've got bragging rights at the moment, quite frankly, Portugal, and granted they've got maybe a generation-defining player, okay?
Greece.
Greece, absolutely. Denmark, in this subsequent time, England have admittedly only once Rugby World Cup champions, but been in three Rugby World Cup finals. Obviously, the England cricket guys have shocked the world and got the 2020 World Cup. They've done the one day internationals. They've won the Ashes. We've had that monkey off the back with Andy Murray winning at Wimbledon. And yeah, grant you the psychological elements. And I feel your pain, chaps. but there's not something bigger and deeper. And one day, I'm sure in a podcast, in almost a galaxy not too far away, we shall put this to bed. Because I'm vehement on this. I think it's deeply wrong, and it's something that can't be hidden away from. And we shall see if Southgate's the man to get us back to that 66 successes. But again, get involved. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. But we've got to get back to sport in tech. Had a great chat this week, chaps, also available in podcast, with St. Albans' own European Tour Golf referee, Gary Tate. He's such a wonderful human being. And we were talking specifically about golf in tech. And again, I'm not going to go into too much detail here, not to the minutiae, because do check out that podcast. It's available, of course, now. But some of the key things there, of course, is the relationship between the ball and obviously the club and the advances accordingly. So, I mean, look, here's a stark fact. And I also appreciate the overall arching embracing of science and sports technology and fitness is going to play factors in these things, grant you that. But this I find almost freakish, and I personally find a touch disconcerting. For instance, Bernard Langer, now into his 50s, a multi-winner, one of the most successful European golfers all time, is now driving the ball longer in his 50s than when he was winning those majors back in the 80s, aged 30. Right? So again, the dynamics of the ball, the way the ball has kind of now been almost this hybrid type fluid filling, again, the advances in clubs is almost making a mockery of courses, because they can just drive it so far. And for me, as a fan of, for instance, back in the day, we were chatting recently in our Hertfordshire Heroes discussion about Faldo, but ultimately, one of the key players all time is Seve Ballesteros. And when you think Seve, he's always kind of almost wrestling against the course. And he was an artist. And I fear, and I had this great chat with Gary, that this era of golf now is almost sacrificing a certain element of artistry at the altar of big booming drives. And in the long run, I think this will be negative. And Gary was saying some fascinating things, that actually there are moves afoot to circumvent this. But as we all know, it isn't just tech in sport. It's tech and its commercial influence in sport. So, for instance, Titleist, Callaway, all the major players in the design of these crazy golf balls and wonderful titanium-based club technologies. They've got such a literally not only vested interest, but a huge invested interest in this trend continuing. And so you would almost get into a legal dilemma if you contravene or go against their wishes to make moves such that that trend of ever bigger booming drives, ever maybe less creativity at the altar of supreme tech. They got, like I say, they are the controlling force over and beyond, arguably, the governing bodies. And that, for me, is deeply disconcerting. But as I say, to delve into much more detail in that conversation, do check out another podcast available today from the Verulam Sports podcasting team, in which I have that chat with Gary Tate, St. Albans' own European Tour golf referee. But just on that kind of broad overview there, guys, what's your thoughts? I mean, am I being a little bit OTT to think that, you know, driving further and further and further is just a little bit odd and maybe not necessarily beneficial? Or should I just kick back and accept it?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's the connection there of the tech to the commercialism side of the sport. And then we see that in Premier League football, don't we, from that perspective. So that is the driver, because the revenue's there to be able to do that. Because there's so much revenue at stake, and that can be referred to any sport now at the top elite level, then people want to try and get that money. They'll do anything for it. So hence why, you know, we've got all this tech, and for me, two thirds of it works well and one third works really, really bad in one particular sport, and that's VAR. And that's driven purely to enable clubs to not get relegated, because it would cost them £110 million. That's really what it comes down to from my perspective.
I think it's a really good point. I mean, goodness me, we know, don't we, that over and beyond the Champions League final, which you'd think would be in sort of a European club-level football, the most glorious event in a course the biggest pass. Not a bit of it. Pales into almost farcical insignificance compared to the net worth value gain of the winners of the playoffs in the sort of Championship One to go into the Premier League. It's, I mean, I don't have the facts off the top of my head, but that is literally the one of the biggest purses in all of sports.
$290 million.
I mean, that's staggering, isn't it? Just thinking of those zeros has given me a little bit of a headache, frankly. Jason, your thoughts quickly circling back to golf tech. And again, this interrelationship between tech and the kind of economic forces at play.
Maybe this is me being machining, maybe Machine McKenna living up to my name. But I don't see a problem with it in terms of the... Maybe I don't understand the nuances of the game, but I think... Why not see how far a human can hit a ball? I think that's amazing. I think that's wonderful.
I tell you what, though, just super quick to cut you short.
Yeah.
Again, it's not per se that I'm anti, but there is actually a very niche sport within golf, which is basically a long driving tournament where literally the only thing these guys do, their whole focus is drive it as long as you want. And I think, awesome. Man, if that's your specialism, that's your thing, go for it. But the thing is, again, the beauty of golf for me is that there's this kind of negotiation between mind, matter, body, and the tech. Because I'm not a total dinosaur. I wouldn't want to go back to sort of Victorian era, sort of that kind of weird golfing style and the little caps and what have you. No. I think it's important. But like I say, again, all four, these select few who are big boomers, and that's what they do. But to just be a big boomer and to kind of be able to just eliminate accordingly the challenges of some of the traps and the water hazards and the trees. And this is what the challenge of golf is, I think, at that elite professional game for me. So, yeah, I understand. But like I say, I just think it's taking a subtle element of what I refer to in golfing context as artistry out of the game at the altar of just behemoth, frightening levels of driving.
For me, though, I think the artistry is still there because you still have to be able to hit it either far enough or a little bit further back because you still have to play the holes. There's certain holes that still, even now, they're so big that you wouldn't be able to drive it all the way. I think it doesn't remove that element. I do see your point that maybe the fact that people can go over the traps, but you see very often there might be a miss hit. You know, these players still have to be at the top of their game to be in the elite elements, and you still have those wonderful putts on the greens or the chips or somebody missing it into, you know, the sand, and then you've got to navigate mm-hmm. around that. So I still think that it's there. I mean, my final question to you for that would be, do you enjoy watching golf less now than you did maybe 20 years ago?
A really, really good question. I'm still a huge lover of golf these days. As you guys know, fell in love with it through that theatre of the Faldo time. And always the thing is, one of the things that I find most compelling about all sports is when you're in an era of people who are transcendental, and there was that Tiger Woods era. It's now moved past, but it was wonderful to see him almost have a renaissance after his difficulties, much publicised last year, getting another green jacket. And to have that challenge that's always there when he's pushing now, he's just four majors away from leveling up with a great quote-unquote winningest of all time, Nicklaus. Tiger has 14, chasing down Nicklaus's record of 18. So to have that component to it, but then also to have the greats underneath that, Bubba Watson, Spieth, and a whole array of others, because of course our own at least from these shores, McIlroy, always going to be there or thereabouts. It's a great era of golf. There's some great characters. I just feel as though there's a little danger, and I know it's well worth listening in depth to this in a little bit more minutiae with Gary Tate's informed opinion, but it's interesting that the power that is in golf, the governing bodies, are at least also likewise concerned about the issue of Uber driving. But now we must drive onwards, and I think it's appropriate to go from golf back into the wonderful world of sporting cliche to say we went through VR, and always the Premier League's coming back excited about it, and it's proven to be a very long marathon indeed not a sprint this year round. But Jason, coming to you to talk about Mr. Marathon Man and his tech and some of the pros versus some of the question marks that abound. Fill us in.
Yeah, well, this is interesting because talking of, you know, hitting the ball furthest, fastest, whatever, with golf, it also comes into the world of marathon running. And you just think, how on earth does that come into it? But there's a huge, huge debate because on October 2019, Eliud Kipchoge ran a marathon in under 2 hours. And you'd think, oh, that's marvelous. That's going to be a world record. But it hasn't gone into the record books. In fact, two world record attempts that Kipchoge has had in 2019 and in 2017, where one did beat it and one was 25 seconds off, have not been recognised by the International Association of Athletics Federations. It's crazy to think, but some people have even asked the question, were those two attempts, should they be called technological doping? Now, I'm just going to walk through the reasons where the questions come into place. So there was a scientist called Michael Joyner that wrote quite a famous journal article about the limits of the optimal human in the optimal conditions of running a marathon. And he postulated that about 1 hour, 57 minutes in lab-like conditions. And what's interesting is Nike and all the Kipchoge team tried to recreate these lab conditions in a perfect run. So they also used Griffith Pugh's research on drag that could shave off minutes in terms of record times in terms of running. So pace setters would use, cyclists were used next to the runners to give them food, water, any sort of sustenance. And also there was a car in front that was streamlining these runners as well. Minimal resistance at all. And the economists actually worked out, they did the number crunching for us on this, that the aerodynamics of it all together probably saved about 2 minutes on this world record. So the fact that he was 20 seconds under shows how important all those elements came together. On top of this, though, the pacers were replaced throughout the race. So at strategical points, let's say every 6 miles, they would come in off the sides and new people would come in. And also in terms of wasted energy, they actually went from a slightly cooler track from 2017. So they used Vienna and they also used the special road, a very long straight road that was left over from the Habsburg Empire. And they were given a few days to kind of choose from. They had a special scientist come in called Robbie Ketchell, who was analysing the data, working out the optimal start date.
Right.
With humidity, wind, precipitation forecasts, all optimal so that they could race. And the course, as I said, was specifically chosen because it was one of the flattest possible. Special lasers were used to show the best, quickest route for Kipchoge. And there was only a 2.4 meter incline across the whole of the track. So in terms of it, you kind of look, every officially recognized marathon around the world is from Berlin. So record times are all that German race because of that reason. So they kind of implemented it there. And finally, probably one of the most controversial elements that contributed to this record time was Kipchoge's shoes. These are very special ones with a springy sole, carbon fiber plates, and especially light materials that it can increase running abilities by 4%. Now, you ask, what's 4%? You know, what can increase by 4%? Well, it's actually, in the tests shown in lab conditions, it was 2 to 6% less metabolic stress and cost to these runners. So it's all about the endurance, isn't it, when you're running marathons? Mm-hmm. That 4% makes so much different. But the technology, kind of like the Speedo technology with swimmers, was patented by Nike. So again, the IAAF said the fact that it's only there for Nike athletes means that it's kind of an unfair advantage to those signed up with them. And the 4% improvement is huge when you think about minutes and seconds. So yes, this record is amazing, but to both of you now, I think it's it is a really important debate. Is this where tech doping goes over the mark? Should this be tech doping? Because it's not a team sport, running is a singular sport, but it had such a huge team to it that it mm-hmm. doesn't seem 100% legitimate. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Jason, I think you've made such a really good overview of this very, very core element, which kind of brings to the fore everything that's kind of been apparent throughout today's debate. There are so many elements of this which you just have to admire. I will say this much quickly before I kind of go down that path. Got to think to myself that Roger Bannister didn't quite have all this when he showed what was possible from the human perspective and the physical endeavors from a running world many moons ago, Chariots of Fire style. But that's kind of neither here nor there. I mean, look, that is astonishing in so many levels. The time and the time taken off it. And again, the military procedure here, the strategic element. And there's so much of this which is almost amazing and, but nevertheless, a little bit alien to me and my sentiments when it comes to sporting and sporting accomplishments. But I'm going to put that in a vacuum just for a second. Because, first of all, again, granted all of this, because here's the question, where does one draw the line? If you think about, you know, forever and a day, maybe even as best as we did know, Bannister's team would have had some type of, dietary considerations to kind of look into this. Because that was once upon a time, the 4-minute mile, impossible. Humans can't do that. What human achievement could she achieve? But with this tech enhancement, it's a fascinating element. But real quickly, I will say this much. I'm not too fussed about the elements of the runners in almost peloton style, because that's kind of one of the effects of the Tour de France and all the kind of major cycle road events in the world. And again, not mega au fait with it, but there's a precedent, which I can kind of see, as you say. But it's still, nevertheless, even with all this military precision, even taking into account all this tech, perhaps enhancing tech doping, to yours, you use your opposite phrase. Here's the thing. It's still a human being running over 26 miles, 26.2 miles to be marathon precise, and in sub 2 hours. It's absolutely astonishing. And what I therefore conclude, just in my slightly naive frame here, because I do have my skeptical side to it as well, but just coming back to that, what it showcases is what we as a species can do, embracing all the things available to us to show that kind of adaptability, that strategic element. But then, granted the Nike enhanced shoe percentage, 4%, whatever it might be, give him this Peloton-esque effect and, of course, the necessary optimum conditions. He's still a human being, completing 26.2 miles in sub 2 hours. Just do the maths and figure out what that would be in terms of how many, what he's actually doing a consecutive 100 meters in, and you would be absolutely blown away. It's beyond belief. It's staggering, and it deserves to be put in the same kind of band as, for instance, the aforementioned Bannister. I truly think so. And also, let's not forget this about Kipchoge. He's an 8-time marathon winner. He actually holds, by all records, and indeed, for want of a better phrase, kosher world record in the marathon, which is just over that 2-hour time, 2 hours, 1 second and 39 microseconds, I guess you'd call it. So again, he's mega pedigree. He's a 3-time Olympian as well. So the guy is a bit of a specimen and somewhat genetically freakishly gifted too. And that's the beauty of all of these sports people for me, doing these freakish feats, which remind us all, the average Joe, the fanatic, of indeed what we are capable of. So yeah, I take the points. I respect the sketchy, dubious side to it. But I think let's take a moment to raise a glass to Kipchoge and team for that astonishing feat. Firing across to you though, Gigi, for your thoughts.
Absolutely. So his background is pretty much, I don't know if you read the book Born to Run. It's a fantastic book, and it talks about individuals such as himself, how he does that daily over the mountains in bare feet. So his whole his biomechanics of his hip to his knees and stuff, yeah, he's conditioned himself to that aspect. So the background is there for that type, first and foremost. The second thing is, I think it's phenomenal to have this individual sport with a team around it to use tech. And I actually, this is one sport I really enjoy, tech and humanity coming together to try and push itself and test itself. I don't want to see that happening all the time in top competitions, but as a test to see what machine and man can do, I think it's phenomenal. And having had the opportunity to train for marathons and run marathons myself, so I've had the joy of running 3 marathons and raising a lot of capital for charities. I had the joy of running the Paris Marathon and 2 London Marathons, which were phenomenal.
Have you tried this Berlin course yet, Graham? By the sounds of it, not. Well, that is the optimum way to kind of experience the marathon experience, so it would seem.
Great point, Tony. And funny enough, the year I was registered to run at Berlin, but I had a severe hamstring tear by playing football, actually, funny enough. And I couldn't go twice, although I was there on the day I should have run. I just obviously wasn't fit enough at the time. And that is quite a flat course. So even amateurs such as myself, we consider that. You know, we don't really want to go for the tough courses. You want to go for the big 5, but you Berlin's really, really good for that sort of points that Jace was picking up on from an amateur point of view. Mm-hmm. But also what was interesting for me is using basic tech. And we can all use this, such as mine was a Garmin. You know, there's obviously other products out there, but my Garmin watch, I love it. I still have it to this day. I've had it for about 10 years and it does everything for me. I can track it by kilometer, mile. I can check my speeds. I can have a little coach to set that coach to. So I'm interacting with that technology through to some nutritional technology, such as gels. The gels are phenomenal. You know, back in the day, your banisters and that wouldn't have touched any of that stuff. But the gel is full of carbohydrate to get into your blood system quite quickly, just to keep you going over that long duration, 26.2 miles. And then on top of
quickly,
it...
Just quickly before you finish that, because I've got to ask you, I'm fascinated here. And I'll just raise a glass to all the marathon runners of the world, because it blows my fragile little mind. It truly, truly does. Talk to me about the experience of the wall.
The wall. It's this big 18 foot by 25 foot brick wall that you just ram into. Obviously not. It's psychological. And it normally happens around the 21st mile, where you've gone through your half marathon, you're buzzing, you're thinking, yeah, I can do this. And then what happens from about 15 to 19 miles, people get carried away and they think, yeah, this is a doddle. So your mind and your body starts doing two different things and your mind plays tricks with you. It's a fascinating experience. And you actually fall into a negative spiral of thinking. You think to yourself, I can't do this. You think 7 miles is quite a long way away, and it is. But when you've just run 19, it's not that bad. And so you sort of get to a point where people just physically either stop and mentally get into a real dark, deep thought and hole. And therefore, they either stop and that's it, game over, or they can pick themselves up and somehow get through. And that's why London is phenomenal, because the spectators just drag you through. Mm. I would say I didn't hit the wall as such, because that was one of my fears running. So I actually trained myself, conditioned myself to try and avoid it. Although I did see in 2030 when I did London, the first London, it was a scorching day after I trained 5 months in the snow. This sun came out of nowhere. And it just got everybody. And what I did see the last 3 miles, and I was doing really well that year. I was on for a good time. Last 3 miles, I saw a lot of great runners collapsed and a lot of paramedics and St. John's ambulance around supporting them. I don't think there was any severe sort of hospitalization of it, but it was just because the conditions of not adapting to the conditions and slowing yourself down and hitting that wall at a time when you thought you were all right. So it's a phenomenal psychological sporting feat to go through. And I encourage everybody to give it a go if they ever get the chance or would like to, because anybody can do it.
Literally raising a glass, Graham. Again, I always appreciate that your inputs to our debates have always got that element of experience, lividness, and it enhances everything here, from the data to the abstract to the kind of bridges we would like to try to be here. But yeah, I appreciate that lived quality. Just final quick question from an amateur marathon running perspective, because I've spoken to several other people who've completed various marathons here, there, London, what have you. And the thing that always kind of I found very staggering, that they're encouraged, and this is not just like a random person, I've heard this on multiple occasions, that before you go into it, you shouldn't actually run 26.2 miles. You should sort of be doing around about the 18, maybe 19. And I always found that a bit weird because, again, I've never tried this yet. But for me, I would kind of psychologically like to know that I could at least do it or have it, did it once. Can you give like the rationale behind that?
Yeah, and it's an interesting, your thinking behind it is really, it makes total sense. It's very logical what you're thinking because, yeah, you want to try and train and get yourself prepared to say to yourself you can do it. But because 26.2 miles is such a tough number and it's such a long distance, so it's, what, 40-odd kilometres, if you do that once, you're not likely to do it again very quickly. Gotcha. It will just take a lot out of you. So you taper up and taper down is what the term is. So mm-hmm. I used to taper up to 20 miles. My 20 miler was my pinnacle to test my physical endurance and my mental endurance. Mm-hmm. And when I got to 20 and I ran it at the times that I wanted to run it at, then I'd taper down knowing I was ready. And I'd time it well to build in injuries and sickness. Mm-hmm. So I knew that 2.5 weeks out from a 20 miler run that I did very well, I knew I was going to nail the 26.2. I didn't know how I was going to nail it because the conditions and the people and how you can get excited.
So many variables. Adapting.
Yeah, exactly. But you definitely don't want to be doing anything over 20. Some people do the opposite and only do 12. Mm. And it's ridiculous. That's dangerous. You know, you don't want to be in that situation either. So you want to get around that 18, 20, even if it's one. Some people do two. Mm-hmm. But all you're doing is conditioning your muscles and getting your body in top tip shape. But a lot of it is mental when it comes to them tough moments.
And this is the thing about Kipkoji, which is why, again, whilst I do accept and love the debate of the different tiers and layers to this, again, what a feat. What a feat of human endeavor, aptitude, will. I think the physicality is a given, but the will on demonstration there for me is the most powerful component of it. And Jason, just want to circle back and I thank you very kindly for bringing this into today's debate. Just before I bring you back, Jason, and again, reminding everybody, if you've got opinions on, I know you have, on everything to do with sport in tech, is Mr. Marathon Man essentially just embracing tech to such a degree that we can't really consider it such a feat of human expertise alone? Or does he reflect what I believe, and Graham, I think, has explained wonderfully, just the necessary fusion of human mind, body, spirit, aligned with the necessary techniques and equipment to really raise the bar? Get your views in. Tweet at Verilum Sport. Of course, talking about bar, earlier on we were talking about VAR. I know you got views on those. Keep them coming. Tweet at Verilum Sport. Want to keep on hearing from you. This is always your show, every bit as much as it is ours. But now it's back to our very own machine for your final thoughts on Kipkoji and his accomplishments or accomplishments?
Very well phrased there, Tony. For me, as I said a little bit earlier, I'm always the person who's going to champion machining and going for the goal. And I love seeing where the human limit is. I just wonder, my question is not if it's an achievement at all. I think it is. And it's one of those psychological barriers as well, because post Roger Bannister, so many people then did the 4-minute mile, yep, and it's been broken and broken and broken again. I just am so excited to see how far we can go if we can reach that 1:57 that the aforementioned scientist said.
Do you know, I think that's a really fascinating point. And on that point, just riffing with it, for me, slightly controversial here, guys, so just hear me out. Because I recognise that this guy, I'm talking about Mr. Usain Bolt from a different area of athletics.
My favourite.
I'm a little disappointed in him.
Oh.
Because no questions about it, he has his place in any pantheon of all-time sporting greats. But I swear to goodness gracious me, if there was a human being on planet Earth more than capable of breaking the 9-second 100-meter sprint, it was Usain Bolt. If you think back to that first gold and how far ahead he was, I mean, that picture of bliss and ecstasy on his face is just one of those sporting moments that will live forever, transcending time. But when you look at the technique and the fact he was so far ahead, and, you know, if he just carried on, powered on, I swear to goodness, he had it in his capability to smash a 9-second 100-meter. I really do believe that. And therefore, for all his accomplishments, as much as I have deep admiration, I'm going to say this much. In terms of pushing the bar and human achievement, when that occurs, some human smashes sub-9-second 100 meters, then we have reached a whole different level on planet Earth. But it could have been Usain Bolt. I truly believe it could have been.
I do have to kind of agree with you a little bit there, Tony. I love Usain. He's one of the best ever. But you do look at that. He was so far ahead, and it was the meme, wasn't it? Usain Bolt celebrates early, you know, he's getting out the champagne as he was crossing the line. It's truly fascinating. It is a controversial point, but I think it's a fair one, because sometimes people did question, you know, the fact that his shoelaces were untied, he was eating chicken nuggets the night before. He is one of those athletes and one of those people that are so ridiculously gifted by God or whatever, genes, whatever you want to call it, that you do think...
A freak in a very positive sense, I would say, right?
Exactly. I just would love to see what his true potential was, because as well, a runner kind of analysed that if he'd just done a few more things to make his technique a little bit more efficient, he could have been right up there smashing that 9-second mark. I don't know what you think, though, Graham. Is that a bit too far to criticise Usain Bolt, the GOAT?
Bring back Linford Christie, I say. I'm joking. And I agree with both of you there. I think he didn't maximise his potential, but he didn't need to. He got what he wanted. And
treble,
it's such
treble.
A shame, because I agree with you there as well, Tony, that he first started out so focused and motivated to achieve. And then he realised there's no one else near him, so he just backed off and enjoyed the ride, right? Such a shame. But at the end of the day, he's still been a brilliant personality, hasn't he? So a great sports personality to look up to and you know, for kids to see as a role model.
Excellent stuff. And again, you know, I'm by no means want to be misconstrued. I have such admiration. I mean, goodness me. Again, he did it over 200 meters. Started out really originally as a 400 meter runner. So had to transition, and hence this slightly odd gazelle-esque running technique, which most purists would almost frown and furrow their brows at. And again, I do love that. But do genuinely believe that he had that capacity, maybe if he had that nearer challenger to kind of eke him on, to keep that mind focused, to smash that 9-second barrier. And again, that would be in much the same way we've discussed Kipchoge. I think that would be something where the world at large, whatever you're doing, the world would stop just for a moment and we'd be united in awe. And I don't believe that it's impossible, because I've said already that I believe it was in the capabilities of Mr. Bolt. So I'm looking forward to the next era, the next generation, possibly inspired by evolving tech, to take that on and to smash that sub-9-second 100 meter is one of those feats. Because like everything, once upon a time, 4-minute mile, it cannot be done. They cannot do it. Well, Sir Roger Bannister did. And as you said, Jason, once that bar is raised, then the human nature is such that we want to go, well, I see your bar raised and I'm going to raise it higher. And that's why I love sport and life. But anyway, I think this has been a real fascinating conversation, just I'm sure people listening have likewise enjoyed. I'm going to wrap this up and keep it reasonably condensed, because I think this has broken down and opened up the nature of the human interface with sports and technology, and both the pros and the cons. I want to focus in finally on the way that certain maybe more niche sports can embrace technology to such a degree that it almost becomes part of their unique selling point. And let's not lose sight of it. One of the other elements of this debate is that relationship between sport and commerce and finance. And also, let's not forget, all sport to some degree is in the competition business for eyeballs and spectators. So anything that can enable more niche sports to get that standout quality, to get people talking about them and it, is for me very, very powerful. And what I'm going to kind of close this up with is specifically about rugby league and the Super League when it began now 26 years ago. So a full generation. And at that time, you know, if you'd have even said to a football fan in a drinking establishment, tell you what, guys, in 25 years, we'll be having this crazy thing called VAR. They'd have laughed you out of the pub. It would have been an absurdity, right? Again, tech and sport has been embraced by the American culture. And Graham, I know you appreciate and have lived also an American sporting culture to a strong extent. NFL, for many moons before this instantiation of the Super League, had been using decision-based, challenge-based kind of appeal system, computer-led. It's part of their culture. But 26 years ago now, when Rugby League kicked off in Sky's tech, with Sky's money as well, which again helped elevate. What they did was they had what we now know in football as VAR, in rugby TMO. Well, basically, whenever there was a question mark over a try, when it wasn't clear cut, they cut to a computer-led, a studio-informed decision, looking at all the replays from all the different possible angles. And obviously, 26 years ago, in the UK, this is revolutionary. But the way it was done was so brilliant because they had this wonderful bombastic music kind of playing out over the PA systems, right? That I can still hear in my mind's ear now. And the whole crowd, instead of kind of having that sense of frustration, oh, this is dragging, it was a borderline theatre of theatrical element to it. And there was that kind of tension in the air because they were privy to the replays being shown. And obviously, you could also see the body language of the player who, Graham, you'll know as an ex-pro. You know in your heart of hearts, don't you? I'm sure Lampard knew that went over the line, to bring it back to that great point you made earlier, Jason. Bottom line is this, though. It was wonderful, and it was so innovative for the time in context in the UK, and it gave that Super League in its first season, and it's continued ever since, a real sort of characteristic quality, a unique quality. And Rugby League remains a very niche sport. In Australia, it's actually the number one sport, even over and beyond cricket. But globally, it's nowhere near its older cousin, rugby union, and in the global panorama of sports, it's at best maybe a footnote, and I mean no disrespect. So the fact that in this country, Rugby League Super League embraced that tech component that we've now kind of having pretty much every sport as standard was so wonderful, so innovative, and so important. And I think accordingly reminds us that innovation can be incredibly positive. It can come part of almost a brand, and that isn't per se bad. In fact, I think, therefore, in this context, really rather positive. Jason, your thoughts?
Yeah, from the way that you've explained it, it kind of adds a dramatic element, almost like the Hawkeye decisions in tennis, that they're clapped and congratulated along. It becomes part and parcel of the drama. I suppose maybe a final question for both of you, for me, from that perspective. Do you think in a similar fashion it will be celebrated a bit like when they paint the lines on the ground now, the referee does, for free kicks and dead ball situations, that the crowd almost celebratory kind of go, way, as it's painted on the ground? Will VAR have a sudden way when the decisions come out? Or is it just going to always be a lamentable, kind of detestable?
I do, yeah. I also remember when football tried to install the kind of, from the rugby culture, whereby it could only be a captain who kind of communicated with the referee. For some reason, that fizzled out.
Yeah.
I really like your question there, Jason. And I will say this much quickly before I throw it across to a man who I know is vehemently at the moment against VAR, Graham. For me, one thing this conversation has shown, one of the major reasons why I love sport in general, is it just reminds us that things change in a heartbeat, that there is nothing that is indeed impossible, and that we always are looking to innovate and change. So for me, Jason, I wouldn't rule anything out. I do come back to overall, the feeling seems to be at the moment, not that it's anti-VAR, but that this needs to be evolved and tweaked. It's almost teething problems. I think in time, because I can't envisage it going away anytime soon, that we will adapt and improve it. I'm at the moment ambivalent to VAR, but I think it's fascinating. I do think we will make those strides forwards. And over time, in the two generations, it's just what was life like before VAR. For instance, I can remember when the passback rule was first initiated. And now, if you speak to people of a certain age, they just can't understand that that was never not a thing, if that makes sense. So we do, we advance, we adapt, we evolve. Rules, physicality, technology, it's all part and parcel of the wonderful tapestry of sport. But Graham, I know you have very, very strong VAR views. Can you imagine a hypothetical universe where you're on board with all things VAR?
No. However, what I want to say quickly is great call with the Super League, Rugby League there, Tony, because obviously the Rugby League game was formed in Huddersfield in 1889 at Huddersfield, the George Hotel, at Huddersfield at the train station there. So that's before the North-South divide thing. That's what it came out of. And they don't seem to really get the exposure as mainly other sports, but bearing in mind it's the 2021 Rugby League World Cup in England next year, so let's see what traction they get from that. In regard to VAR, well, this is the question. So I actually feel that VAR will be around, but it won't be as detailed or as involved as it currently is. I think it's going to be reduced. And as I said earlier, I think it's going to be reduced to penalties and maybe one other, whatever that might be, because it's spoiling the game. And the reason it's spoiling the game is for this reason alone, I believe, which is the fan experience. Mm-hmm. And what I'm really interested in going forward to wrap up from my side tonight is that in 20 years' time, we might not have a generation of people that are going to go to football stadia, right? Think about that. Mm. Because it's potentially the new thing is going to be virtual fan experiences where people won't leave the home. So you've got an issue there, haven't you? When you've got a generation of people that might not even have the disposable income to pay the increasing fines. In particular, I'm talking now Premier League football. Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting time in the next 20 years in Premier League football and things like VAR making the game better or worse. So people's patience will dry thin. I know quite a lot of people now that have supported Premier League teams, Championship teams for a long, long time, all their lives, and have turned their back on it because of these reasons and many others. And they're going to support local teams, you know, in particular for us at St. Albans, that's fantastic, right? And you don't get the same quality and high pitch, but you do get local football, you know, some true grit going on and people playing the game. So I think the authorities have got a huge, it's a really sensitive time. They've got to get this right because there's a big push and there's a lot of research going into the virtual fan experience. In other words, you're not paying for a ticket to get in, but you're paying for something to watch that match day experience.
Graham, as always, I tell you what, your insights are so powerful. Oh, God, no, there's something a bit scary about that. I'm already a little bit worried about empty stadia at the moment because one of the things that I find fascinating, and we'll talk about it another time, but I just want to sort of leave this particular conversation on this particular note. One of the things that I love about sport as well, I'm sure many people empathize and get where I'm coming from here, is that sense of momentum that shifts so rapidly so many times. And sometimes that shift can be the 11th man or the 12th man, the fan itself, uniting, just screaming on and kind of willing them on. And that can find a living spark within a player, an individual player, or indeed then the collective team. And that interaction, that relationship between the fan at the ground, who for me are the real, real fans, actually. The guys who do go week in, week out, up and down the land, right? I raise a glass to anybody in that category. I know it's going to be tough, but I'm a little bit concerned about that. We'll see how it pans out. I know the Bundesliga is already underway. And again, the Premier League returns next week. We'll talk all things Premier League next week. But as I say, you make some wonderful points, but they are, for me, a little bit disconcerting. I think the key overarching point, both when it comes to sport and tech, sport and fan management, and sport and its place in the wider world and in context, is that this is, as with everything now, a very telling time where serious, important questions must be posed by those with the power to control the vision and focus that it takes. That's not a bad thing. It's a great challenge. And I'm challenging you to get involved with us and give us your opinions on all things sport and tech, and indeed all things pertaining to sport. This is always your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So keep involved. I'm also challenging those who may well be listening in places of influence within the sphere of sport. You must now listen closely to the man on the street. You must take on board feedback. You must be willing to pose yourself these serious questions in order to embrace, adapt, evolve, and then come back ever stronger. I'm optimistic always. I'm raising my half glass of now almost stone cold tea. So this wonderful team, award-winning team of Verum Sports Podcasting. This has been Tony Rice alongside the amazing machine, Jason McKenna, and the ever erudite Graham Griffin. I'm thanking you once again for listening, reminding you to stay tuned because there's also coming up a great chat with Gary Tate, European Tour Golf referee from St. Albans. And next week, you're going to want to listen to this. There's going to be Premier League debates. It's kicking off. I can't wait. In that empty stadium, granted. Plus, of course, Richard Walker, head of comms from Watford Football Club, will be back to preview, to build up to Watford versus Leicester as it remains a dogfight for the Hornets. Keep involved. I want to hear from you at Verum Sport. Thanks again for your time and wish you, wherever you are, every continued joy and happiness. Thanks for listening.